Hi, and welcome to Neuro-Linguistic Programming Strategies, or also known as NLP. Now, you've probably heard me say, if you're a hammer, everyone is a nail. That is why we often find in the world of persuasion that most people only use one, two, if we're lucky, three persuasion tools. And what they're doing is they're using them over and over again in almost every persuasive situation. You know, certainly the basics will always pertain in any persuasive situation, but the danger lies in ending up treating everyone exactly the same way. How do you customize and adapt to each particular person you're working with? There are many different camps out there in the world of persuasion. And my goal at the Persuasion Institute is to find out what is working, what's not working, and teach you the different skills of persuasion. To find the whole pie of persuasion. Again, there's many camps out there. You have the NLP camp, which is Neuro-Linguistic Programming, and they believe that that is the key to success. There's some truth to that. Others believe that you only need to learn about closing skills from expert trainers like Brian Tracy, Tom Hopkins, or Zig Ziglar. Still, others feel that Dale Carnegie's people skills are the way to go. And you hear people using fear and coercion. And some just focus on personality styles. Now, all these camps are great. Each has much to offer, but individually, they each represent only a small part of the persuasion pie. To be the most powerfully persuasive individual at all times in any situation, you have to have all the available tools under your belt. NLP is one of those fundamental pieces to the persuasion pie that many times gets overlooked. So, let's focus on the basics of NLP so you can add them to your persuasion toolbox. So what is NLP? Neuro-linguistic programming, as it's called today, is a very interesting science. It was developed by UC Santa Cruz professor John Grinder and his graduate student Richard Bandler. Its basic premise is that one's thought patterns, beliefs, and attitudes can be used to pre-program actual experiences that are yet to happen. NLP is very focused on how we think, what influences the way we think, and how we structure what we think. Subscribers to the science are encouraged to closely study and then model those individuals who do things well. When studying them, you don't ask them how they did it, just what they were thinking when they did it. For example, if you ask Michael Jordan how to play basketball, he could give you a big long list of do's and don'ts. He might outline a series of necessary drills, but that is not what NLP is all about. Instead, you would find out how Michael Jordan perceives basketball in his mind. What are his beliefs and his attitudes about basketball? When he makes a decision on the court, what is he thinking? NLP is made up of several different models, each having different techniques associated with it. Let's break down NLP down further and take a basic look at some of its major models. And there are many models of NLP. I like to stick with the ones that I know that have worked, that have proven to work. There are many NLP practitioners out there that have kind of given NLP a bad name, but let's listen to these and talk about the things that I know work. The first is submodalities, or what we call the five senses. The thing is, each of us takes in the world around us through our five senses: seeing, hearing, feeling. Now, that feeling can be both tangible and emotional. We also have tasting and smelling. Everything and anything we think about in life and the resulting belief and attitudes we form can be based on what we receive and then interpret through these submodalities. Taking it a step further, with the entirety of our life experiences encapsulated in our memories as we experience them through our senses, we can recreate those experiences in our mind, alter them if need be, and thus gain tremendous power over our thought patterns, beliefs, and ultimately the outward manifestation of our capabilities and achievements. The way you structure these representations in your mind determines how you'll respond. Let's try a basic experiment. Picture someone in your mind you hold very dear to your heart. Now, in your mind's eye, enhance and intensify the colors of the image and observe how you respond. What happens when you turn up the volume of what has been said? What about if you visualize the image in shades of gray instead of color? For most people, turning up the colors or sounds also intensifies feelings, while turning them down diminishes those feelings. Cultivating your ability to fine-tune the way you perceive things or the way your mind represents things can be used to make powerful changes in your life. Once you realize that you can, in essence, create your world, you also realize that you have the power to change it. Then there's the meta model. A meta model is a set of questions that are developed for specific purpose of finding the exact meaning in a person's communication. For example, often when we communicate, we generalize or may even distort information or leave it out altogether. That could be intentionally or unintentionally, consciously or subconsciously. Individuals who use meta models are able to systematically verify and clarify both verbal and written communication in order to communicate even more clearly and precisely. Then there's sensory acuity. Our thought processes are very closely tied to our physiology. For example, people can sense that you're happy, scared, or angry without you even saying anything. Body language, as we know, sends out strong cues about how we're feeling. That is, our posture, our eyes, our head position, all say a lot about us. Most body language is fairly obvious, but sensory acuity takes all these observations beyond the obvious and uses physical feedback in addition to verbal communication to be as discerning as possible. Verbal cues even give some suggestion of which sensory modality a person operates from most strongly. For example, if someone says, "I hear what you're saying," versus "I see what you mean," it suggests their auditory sense is more dominant than their visual one. It is helpful to give this concept consideration since miscommunication can often simply result from two people trying to talk about the exact same thing, only in different ways. Some experts argue that if a certain thought processes are reinforced enough over a long enough period of time, they can actually alter a person's physiological state. The Milton Model, which is named after Milton Erickson, he is known as the father of modern hypnotherapy. And what this is a set of linguistic patterns that are designed to guide an individual without actually disrupting the way they're experiencing the particular activity internally. Okay, let me give you an example on this. The command, for example, when you say, "Recall a time when you were crying," doesn't dictate whether the person was sobbing uncontrollably or weeping softly in the memory. This skill of describing feelings, places, events, and activities in a manner that is specific and yet is still universal allows the user to develop rapport with their subject. It also helps move the subject into a trance-like state. As a result, the Milton Model is commonly used to induce hypnosis. Then there are metaprograms. Metaprograms are essentially the looking glasses through which we view the world. You know, the classic, is the glass half full or half empty? Is a perfect metaprogram example. Metaprograms control our personality and therefore how we behave. For instance, do you tend to be more of an active or passive person? Do you focus more internally or externally on the world around you? Is your orientation more focused on the past, the future, or the here and now? Two people may regard the exact same thing from totally different angles, to the extent that the exact same thing may actually become a very different thing altogether. Another example, do you move towards your goals, or do you move away from the things that are not your goals? One may simply seem like an inverted restatement of the other, but each has its own distinct nuance. Another part of NLP is what we call embedded commands. An embedded command is a suggestion that is hidden within written or spoken language. It is used to communicate to the conscious mind while also sending a message to the subconscious mind. The intent is to actually bypass the conscious mind and communicate directly to the subconscious mind. Since embedded commands usually remain undetected by the conscious mind, they are very commonly used in marketing and advertising. It is in this covert way that marketers can create expectations and desires within their audiences without encountering any resistance. Often, the embedded commands are small fragments that fit into a full sentence. For example, Pepsi used to have the slogan that encouraged, "Have a Pepsi Day." Now, when you look at that, the embedded command was, "Have a Pepsi." The most effective embedded commands are short and concise. In fact, ideally, they should be no longer than 2 to 4 words. It is much easier to use these commands in persuasive writing than in persuasive speaking because you can visually highlight the command with boldface or italic font. For example, when using this persuasive technique, first determine what exactly you are trying to say to your audience. Then create the sentences where the embedded words and phrase will logically and contextually fit. Finally, set the embedded commands apart in some visual way. You could italicize them, boldface, underline, highlight them, or even use a different color. While harder to emphasize, embedded commands are also a powerful tool in persuasive speaking. Certain phrases have specific command forms that follow the 2-4 words rule. Effective phrases can include word associations, cause and effect statements, presuppositions, questions, hidden suggestions, or even analogies. Essentially, when incorporating embedded commands into spoken presentations, we are looking for phrases that jump out at us. Now, consider the following examples. Become wealthy. Buy now. Use this material. How good it feels. Going to happen. Read each word. Feel good. Follow my lead. Act now. Change your life. Become really interested. You will understand. Learn this material easily. Invite you to notice. Use this process. Learn quickly. Enjoy life. Use a skill. Learn how. Or improve your results. Studies show that embedded commands can actually change our attitudes or beliefs, even if we are totally unaware they have. Embedded commands are effective simply because the conscious mind has no opportunity to analyze or evaluate them. Because of this, we can create expectations of behavioral changes with embedded commands, as well as with and direct indirect suggestions. The subconscious mind will create an internal reality to match the commands being received. Another aspect of NLP is pacing and leading. Pacing involves establishing rapport and making persuasive communication easier, while leading involves steering your prospect toward your point of view. Pacing and leading enable you to direct people's thoughts so they tend to move in your direction. When you pace, you validate your prospects either verbally or nonverbally. That is, your prospects perceive you to be in agreement with them. Consequently, they feel comfortable with both you and the situation. Pacing entails using statements everyone accepts to be true. What that means is they cannot be argued with. By eliminating this disagreement, resistance and defensiveness are low, placing you in a good position to begin leading. While everyone is in agreement, you gradually and incrementally introduce your stance's key points. This is how leading is different from pacing. You are not setting forth statements that are unequivocally true as in pacing. Rather, when leading, you are setting forth what you want the prospect to accept. The key difference between the two concepts is that one sets the stage for the other to work effectively. Another is presuppositions. Using expectations, we can create immediate reactions to stimuli so that the prospects don't even have to think. They just perform the requested action. Discounts, closeouts, going out of business sales, and coupons are used to draw traffic to stores. Consumers receiving such offers assume they will receive a reduced purchase price by presenting the coupon or by going to the going out of business sale and act accordingly, whether or not they really will receive a better price. One company actually made an error in printing on their coupon. It was misprinted, and when they looked at the coupon closely, it really offered no savings whatsoever. Now, despite the lack of savings, the coupon produced just as much customer response as did the error-free coupon. Presuppositions use words and language to indicate the assumption that your offer, your product, your service has already been accepted. It is a technique that your prospect may or may not process, but it is still effective either way. Now consider the following examples. When you say, "When do you want your furniture delivered?" you're implying is you want the furniture. Or you say, "Should I call you Tuesday or Wednesday?" you're implying they want to receive the phone call. Or when you say, "Your first class will start next Monday," you're implying they're signing up for a class. It is amazing how often people will go along with your proposal, even if it's quite far from what they're originally thinking. Now, just to remind you that 95% of persuasion involves a subconscious trigger, and that's where NLP works. They often don't even stop to think about responding to you because their subconscious has already processed the deal as being finished. Another way to use a presupposition is to put it in writing. People always think that if something is in writing, it must be true. We often go along with something we see without questioning it just because that's what the directions say to do. For example, a particular candid camera stunt involved a stop sign placed on the sidewalk, even though there was no reason to stop there. The sign was in an odd place, and there was no danger of oncoming traffic, but everyone obediently stopped and waited at the sign just because that's what it said to do. In another spoof, candid camera had a sign when people were going into Delaware, it said, "Delaware closed." And people actually stopped and started asking, well, how long is it going to be closed? When can we go in? Written communication can be very powerful. Another one I've seen work very, very well, and I've seen the research on, is mirror and matching. Now, John Grindler and Richard Bandler developed the concept of mirror and matching. The idea is to match your prospect's demeanor. Not actually mimic their every move, but match their mood and tone. You can safely mirror things such as language, posture, gestures, and mood without seeming phony. The whole point of this strategy is to develop rapport with your prospects and help them feel more comfortable. Because of your similar demeanors, they will feel a connection with you. Remember that people are inclined to follow those they perceive as similar to themselves. If your prospects shift in their posture, you should eventually do so too. If they cross their legs, you should cross your legs as well. If they smile, you smile too. When you mirror your prospects, they will subconsciously feel you have much more in common with them than may actually be the case. Now, this is a natural course of nature. We often subconsciously mirror others. You watch people at a party that have connected, they have the same stance and posture. It is natural. At all social gatherings, people mirror each other and mirror their attitudes. For example, when two people greet each other, they tend to use the same posture and behave the same. When you're a master persuader, you will make skillful and conscientious use of mirroring. Now, you could also mirror language. You will be amazed at the effectiveness of using the same vocabulary or lingo your prospects use. To increase your persuasiveness, pick up on and use some of the words or phrases that your prospects use. You may also find it helpful to mirror your prospect's rate of speech. For example, if he speaks in a slower and more relaxed tone, you could do the same, although you still want to keep the enthusiasm in there. And likewise, if they speak quickly, feel free to do the same. You could also match their voice. This is different from matching their language. Voice matching refers to mirroring the actual tone or inflection of your prospect's voice. Be very careful, however, that you do not come across as mimicking. The mirrored voice should never be so different or foreign from your own that you arouse suspicion. Just minor and subtle adjustments in tone are all necessary to get the desired results. Then there's mirroring moods. When you reflect your prospect's mood, you give validation to what they're saying and feeling. We often verbally mirror another's mood by restating what they've said. So what I hear what you're saying is, or I think I would feel that way too if I'd been through that. When you mirror your prospect's mood, be sure your tone is very sincere. When you sincerely acknowledge your prospect's comments, concerns, and feelings, your persuasive power increases. And that goes along with matching their energy level. Some people will always be relaxed and mellow. Others seem to be constantly active and vivacious. Seek to mirror your prospect's energy level. This will just be another subtle way in which you are in sync with the prospect. This technique is also effective when giving a group presentation. Match the overall energy level present in the room or adopt the level of energy emanating from the group. This is so important. We see so many rookie persuaders that are high energy, high enthusiasm, contacting somebody who's just having a normal or below normal day, and the different energy levels clash and there's no connection. Can you imagine if you're depressed and you called a suicide hotline and someone answered, "Hello, suicide hotline, it's a great day today, how can I help you?" Wow, you would clash. And many of you are doing that with your prospects. Now, sometimes you might want to break the mirror. Now, there are certain occasions you want to do this. Now, for example, a lawyer will often seek to create anxiety or an uneasiness in a witness. To accomplish this, the one key thing the lawyer needs to do is not mirror. While the witness may be slumped back in the seat looking at the ground, the lawyer may be hovering or standing rigidly and looking intensely at the witness's face. Have you ever noticed or felt uneasiness when someone suddenly stood in the middle of a conversation where everyone else was seated? Have you ever experienced the awkwardness of glancing at your watch when you were in the middle of a conversation with someone and they noticed? Breaking the mirror breaks the synchronization that makes everyone feel calm and comfortable. If you need to break the mirror, simply stop mirroring and sit, speak, or gesture differently from the person you're dealing with. You can create even further distance by altering your demeanor abruptly or suddenly. Securing your prospect's trust and interest is one thing, but keeping the energy level high and maintaining the connection is another. Most persuaders don't know how to keep the rapport with their prospects going. Usually people in sales break the ice. They find similarities with their prospects. They build rapport for the first 5 minutes. Then they launch into this presentation. All of a sudden, they get serious. They change their demeanor. What is the prospect going to think when the transformation takes place? The person he has been talking to for the past 5 minutes has now unexpectedly changed. Which one is the real person? The two are getting along, having fun, and all of a sudden, without warning, the salesperson became serious and dove into a sales pitch. This shift in demeanor breaks rapport and seems incongruent to the prospect. You both know why you are there and what the ultimate goal will be, so continue to build on the rapport. Connecting with your prospects takes time, research, and practice to master. Another interesting aspect of NLP is what we call anchors. Anchors is a technique that captures the feelings, memories, and emotions of certain events, places, or things. The psychology behind anchoring technique's success lies in the use of elements from a previous situation or circumstance to replay that experience's emotions and feelings in the mind. An anchor can be anything that brings up a thought or feeling and reminds you of something you have previously experienced. It will usually reproduce the exact same emotion or feeling you experienced in the past. Remember the experiment of Pavlov's dog? Anchoring's the same idea. You use a certain stimulus to create a mental association that will bring about a particular response. An anchor can be produced either externally or internally. Anchors don't have to be conditioned over a period of several years to be established. They can be learned in a single event. The more powerful the experience, the stronger the anchor will be. Phobias are an excellent example of effective anchors. Most phobias are established after one single intense experience. So let's talk about three different sets of anchors. Smells are all olfactory system, music, and symbols. Now there are other elements, sights and tastes, and other anchors that can be used anchors, but these three types of anchors are the most powerful stimuli in invoking memories. So let's talk about smells or the aroma of persuasion, because our sense of smell is so powerful that it can quickly trigger associations with memories and emotions. Our olfactory system is a primitive sense that is wired directly to the center of our brain. By 4 to 6 weeks of age, infants can tell the difference between their own mother's scent and that of a complete stranger. Almost everyone has experienced situations in which a smell invoked a nostalgic memory. Think of the smells that take you back to your childhood. You could smell fresh baked bread, fresh cut grass, chlorine of the swimming pool, the smell of the beach. You could go back 50 years in a matter of seconds with a sense of smell. Fragrances and aromas and odors trigger memories, feelings, and attitudes in our minds. Smell can enhance or reinforce desired responses as well as positive and negative moods. There are multiple examples of the scent triggering. Supermarkets with bakeries fill the air with the warm aroma of the breads and coffee. Some children's stores send a baby powder through their air ducts. When you walk through the mall, the fast food merchants will make sure you smell their cookies, their cinnamon rolls, or even their Chinese food. And real estate agents are famous for having homeowners bake bread before they have an interested buyer tour the house. Large amusement parks will pipe in certain scents at certain times of the day to trigger responses and get immediate reaction. The use of smell in these instances is an attempt to link a seller's products and services with a positive attitude, thereby inducing the shopper to buy. In the same way, you can link positive smells with your message to create positive attitude in your prospects. There have been numerous studies conducted on the bearing scent has on association. There was a study done on a university level, and it found that female students wearing perfume were rated as more attractive by male students. Simple as that. Perfume is a billion-dollar industry. Scents are even found to improve scores on job evaluations, and in a study published in the Journal of Applied Psychology, they also found on the flip side, offensive odors can also be used to invoke a negative response. This offensive odor tactic was once used while campaign committees were rating and appraising political slogans. Not surprisingly, rating for the slogans went down when they smelled an offensive odor. Then there's music. Music is much like smells, in that our brains link music with attitudes and experiences from our past. Music is closely tied to our emotions. Think of the theme music from Rocky and then think of Jaws. The two movie themes evoke different emotions, don't they? Local gyms often pipe upbeat music outside the gym to get people walking by to associate the gym with high energy and good times inside. In one case, a local convenience store had problems with teenagers loitering outside. Now, the store wanted the teenagers' business, but they didn't want them hanging out. There could be drugs and fights. They wanted them to leave. The store owner would call the police, but they would leave by the time the police arrived. So what they decided to do is they put up speakers on the outside, and they started playing Frank Sinatra music on the outside of the stores. And what do you know? The teenagers voluntarily stopped loitering. And on a personal level, you still may remember that particular song played during the dance with your high school sweetheart. Music has a powerful pull on all of us and triggers instant memories. Because music is so powerful, persuaders need to carefully select the songs they're going to use. Advertisers often use a popular song or even a catchy jingle. Notice the next time you watch television or how many songs you recognize from the commercials. You'd probably be surprised. Every time the ad is played, the tune reinforces the product's appeal. Music is universal because it has the power to evoke the emotions shared by all of humanity. Then there's symbols. We live in a very symbolic world. Symbols bypass our thoughts and our logic, and they affect our perceptions and behaviors. Take gold, for example. One of the world's most precious metals, gold is very symbolic of wealth and success. Countless stories are told of the search of gold, but if you stop and think about it, there are other precious metals that are harder to find and far more precious. Gold just holds a certain symbolism. It denotes success and wealth. Symbols can also help us understand and feel a message without actually having to undergo the experience. For example, a skull and crossbone on poison says it all. You don't have to ingest the poison to understand the fatal experience it could cause. The simple symbol of a red stop sign triggers an automatic response. For many, you could be driving down the highway, keeping the speed limit, and the sight of a police car on the highway will also trigger an automatic braking response. Think of these symbols as I say them. Pay attention to your feelings, your memories, your attitudes, and experiences they trigger in your mind. Christmas tree. Wedding dress. Olympics. Military uniform. Swastika. American flag. World Trade Center. Statue of Liberty. Star of David. Crucifix. When you are trying to mold attitude as a persuader, it is useful to know how symbols shape the attitudes of your audience. Make careful study and research of the symbols you want to use before you employ them. If used well, they will influence your audience's feelings and behavior to your benefit. Marketing and advertising executives use symbols in a very sophisticated way to manipulate consumers. For example, did you know that the average child recognizes McDonald's arches before they are even 20 months old? There are symbols of freedom, symbols of success, symbols of failure, and symbols of poverty. Find and use the symbols you need to create the proper association with your prospect. And on another note, you need to learn to engage all five senses. We were born with five senses, each one helping us make generalizations about the world. You should engage all five sensations when trying to persuade an audience. However, keep in mind that there are three dominating senses we all tend to gravitate toward. They are sight, hearing, and feeling, or also known as visual, auditory, and kinesthetic. When we learn, 75% of knowledge comes to us visually, 13% comes through hearing, and 12% comes through smell, taste, and touch. Most people tend to favor one of these perceptions over the others. As a great persuader, you need to identify your prospect's dominant perspective on the world. But the point is to find the dominant perception. As you determine the dominant learning mode, consider the size of your audience. If you were speaking to one person, for example, you would want to pinpoint their dominant perception. If you have an audience of 100, on the other hand, you need to employ all three learning styles. If you were to ask an auditory person to be an eyewitness to a robbery, he would describe the situation in this manner. I was walking down First Avenue, listening to the singing birds. When I heard a scream for help, the yelling got louder. There was another scream, and then the thief ran off. A visual person might describe the same situation this way. I was walking down First Avenue, watching the birds playing in the air. When I noticed a large man coming around the corner, I saw him attack the other man, take his wallet, and run from the scene. And the kinesthetic or feeling person would use this description. I was walking down First Avenue, and I felt a lump in my throat because I had a feeling something bad was going to happen. There was a scream and there was tension. I knew there was a man getting robbed. I felt helpless to do anything. The most commonly prevalent of the senses is sight or visual perception. One study showed that those who used visual presentation tools, for example, PowerPoint, overheads, slides, were 43% more persuasive than subjects who didn't. Also, those using a computer to present their visual aids were considered more professional, interesting, and effective. Visually oriented people understood the world according to how it looks to them. They noticed details like an object's shape, color, size, and texture. They say things like, I see what you mean. From your point of view, how does that look to you? I can't picture it. Do you see what I mean? They tend to use words like see, show, view, look, watch, or even observe. Auditory people perceive everything according to sound and rhythm. Phrases we'd commonly hear would be, I hear you. That sounds good to me. Can you hear what I'm saying? That doesn't ring a bell. Or, let's talk about it. They use words such as hear, listen, sounds, ring, speak, and verbalize. Kinesthetic people go with what they feel, not only in a tactile way, but also internally. They are very into feelings and emotions. A kinesthetic person would say things like, feels right to me. I'll be in touch with you. Did you feel that? I understand how you feel. I can sense it. And you'll hear words such as feel, touch, hold, connect, grasp, sense, lift, and understand. Just one last comment on visual, auditory, and kinesthetic sensations. A general way to tell which type describes a particular person is to watch the movement of their eyes when they have to think about a question and make sure the question is difficult enough that they have to ponder it for a moment. Generally, but not 100% of the time, if a person looks up, they are visual. When they look to either side, they're auditory. And when they look down, they're kinesthetic. Understand, I'm simplifying a very complicated science. There's other aspects to this. But if you try, you'll be amazed at the accuracy of this technique. Another aspect of NLP is known as binds, or offering choices. Because there is a strange human psychological phenomena in regards to drawing conclusions. If someone tells us exactly what to do, our natural human tendency is to reject it simply because it has been dictated. The solution is to offer your prospects a few options so they can make the choice for themselves. People feel the need to have freedom and make their own choices. If forced to choose something against their will, they experience psychological resistance and feel a need to restore their freedom. We all need options. Recently, while I was vacationing in a national park, I saw a moose. It was a young moose, and it was surrounded by people. They all wanted to get a picture. It was in this small lake. It felt trapped, and when it felt trapped, the moose charged at the people, wanted to escape. The same scenario can crop up in your persuasive efforts. If you don't offer options to your audience, they could attempt to charge and escape. The way in which this technique still gives you an advantage is that it gives you control over your prospects' options. As a master persuader, you only give them options that will satisfy your situation. We've all done this type of thing with our children. Do you want to finish your dinner or go to bed early? In persuasion and sales, they call this strategy the alternative close. For example, have you heard the line, do you want it in regular or deluxe? Do you want it in blue or green? Do you want to meet Monday afternoon or Tuesday evening? The prospect is presented with options, but both options are pleasing to the persuader. Even if it's something simple, people need to have options. Heard a story about a lady who desperately needed to take her medication or she could die. Her doctor, her nurse, her son, her husband, all try to get her to take medication, but to no avail. The doctor insisted she take her medicine first thing when she arose in the morning. She just wouldn't do it. Distraught, the family took her to a new doctor. The doctor immediately saw the situation and talked to the patient. He explained the benefits of taking the drugs and how it could help her. Then he gave her an option. He said, you need to take this once a day. Would you like to take it with your breakfast or your dinner? The patient smiled and she decided she would like to take it with her dinner. It was her choice. Because even when there's only one option, many times we just feel a subconscious resistance to that option. Because after this patient made the decision, she no longer gave people a hard time about taking her medication. The key was that both options the doctor gave her accomplished the same thing. If you absolutely have to limit your audience's choice to one thing, you must explain to them why there are limitations to their options. If your audience understands why a limit has been put on their freedom, they are more likely to accept it without feeling undermined. On the flip side, try not to give your prospects more than two or three choices. If you offer too many alternatives, your audience will be less likely to choose any of them. Structured choices give the audience the impression of control. As a result, they increase in cooperation and in commitment. Like I mentioned earlier, offering choices is also called binds or double binds in the world of NLP. Each option offered gives a persuader what they want without making them appear as if they're restricting freedom. When you use the word or in your persuasive efforts, the very opposite is implied. So try to structure your prospect's choices with the word or. For example, would you like to make an appointment now or should we meet next week? So remember, there are many camps out there in the world of persuasion. My goal at the Persuasion Institute is to find what's working, what's not working, give you all the tools possible in the world of persuasion. This was just a basic overview of the broad world of NLP. Study and apply these concepts carefully to enhance your persuasive ability. Used correctly, NLP can definitely enhance your persuasive abilities. Again, some have given it a bad name. As with anything, you study, learn to be a student, not just a follower. What I mean by this is don't accept everything you learn at face value. Try it, practice it, and see if it works for you. That is how you master the world of persuasion. Go out, study, try these principles, and you'll see a big difference in your future, your success, and your income.